from WNYC in New York. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Sometimes when the messiness of the world gets us down, we seek release in fiction. You know, the perfect politician, the ideal president. And yet eventually that bubble must burst. You know what I mean. And so without further ado, we start the show with something of an election 2016 requiem for a fictional candidate, Vice President Joe Biden.
Unfortunately, I believe we're out of time, the time necessary to mount a winning campaign for the nomination.
What a long, strange trip it's been for the sometimes surging, sometimes lagging, never-existing Biden campaign. It all began late this summer when the media breathlessly announced that the vice president had not made a formal announcement that he was entering the ring.
Speculation is growing this morning that Vice President Joe Biden could soon announce he's running for president. This amid Hillary Clinton's declining poll numbers and a growing...
That was August. Suddenly, the possibilities seemed boundless, the polling interminable.
In the political world tonight, all eyes on Vice President Joe Biden. New poll numbers show he's riding a wave of popularity over Hillary Clinton.
Joe Biden still polling very well in some key states and in national matchups.
The latest poll shows Biden moving into second place, gaining 10 points since August.
And adding to the suspense, the all-too-brief fictional campaign of fellow former Vice President Al Gore, the non-comeback kid.
The White House is heating up with rumors about former Vice President Al Gore throwing his hat into the ring.
Dramatic comeback? He won the popular vote 15 years ago. So could Al Gore be making a run in 2016?
The rest, of course, is not history. The months of Biden not campaigning in Iowa, New Hampshire, the stump speeches he didn't give, the ads he didn't approve, and of course, the debate, which everyone agreed Vice President Biden soundly did not participate in. CNN.
Will the Air Force Two suddenly start flying westward toward Las Vegas on Tuesday night? A dramatic landing at McCarran International Airport. The speeding motorcade over to the Wynn Hotel. Biden with the aviator glasses put on as he walks into the... Will we see some kind of dramatic political moment?
Conservative commentator Bill Kristol told ABC's This Week that his Bidey sense was tingling as late as last Sunday.
Joe Biden's going to get in, I'm quite confident. I think he'll get in tomorrow or Tuesday. He'll go to Delaware. Presumably, and announced to the state he represented.
Instead, we had to wait until Wednesday for the other shoe not to drop. Meanwhile, in more Back to the Future news, this week Republican Rep. Mo Brooks of Alabama proposed the ahistorical impeachment of President Hillary Clinton on her first day in office.
On Thursday, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton testified before the House Select Committee on Benghazi. A nearly 11-hour-long interrogation led by Congressman Trey Gowdy of South Carolina.
Madam Secretary, I understand there are people, frankly, in both parties who have suggested that this investigation is about you. Let me assure you it is not.
The Select Committee is now in its 17th month, longer than the Watergate investigation and the probes into Hurricane Katrina and Pearl Harbor. Even Republicans have come forward to say the committee is aimed at the Democratic frontrunner's reputation. Clinton's opening statement didn't shy away from the hyper-politicized fray.
Despite all the previous investigations and all the talk about partisan agendas, I'm here to honor those we lost and to do what I can to aid those who serve us still.
In the immediate aftermath, a host of conservative pundits took to Twitter to criticize various Republicans for their lines of questioning. The Drudge Report made a headline of Clinton's coughing fit. Slate's Jim Newell observed that no one on the committee performed particularly well, saying that the Republicans badgered her with tangential questions about emails to and from her friend Sidney Blumenthal, while the Democrats, quote, are essentially narrating campaign commercials for her. The hearing is well on its way to producing a gray blob of mush for the general public to consume or, more likely, ignore. So, let's. Instead, we'll present one of our favorite Benghazi sidebars. One of the four Americans killed in the Benghazi attack was Information Management Officer Sean Smith. We never heard much about him. In news reports, he and some of the other casualties were usually referred to like this.
Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans.
Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans.
U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans were killed in that attack.
In January of last year, former OTM producer and TLDR co-host Alex Goldman reported about a little-known area of Smith's life.
In Benghazi, Sean's job was to make sure the electronics that American diplomats relied on worked. But of course that's not all he was. In his life outside of the State Department, Sean was a husband and father to two kids. But in order to really understand Sean Smith, you have to understand the online world which he inhabited. One of Sean's best friends explains.
My name is Alex Jancherko, and I guess for the purposes of this interview, you're interested in my space identity, which is I'm the Mitanni in a silly little online game called EVE Online.
Calling EVE Online little is a misnomer. While it may look like a simple outer space shoot-em-up, even by normal online gaming standards, EVE is sprawling and incredibly complex.
What makes it unique is most games have small servers. So you'll be playing a game with, you know, maybe 50 people, maybe 100 people, maybe 1,000 people.
In EVE, there's 500,000 users who can interact with each other at the same time, which gets complicated. What's emerged in EVE over time are player hierarchies called alliances that broker and maintain peace between factions. They also steal, lie, and spy on each other.
You know, in other games, that's against the rules. EVE Online is more like Somalia in space on the internet, where there's no rule of law, it's just whatever goes.
Alex actually quit a job in corporate law a couple years ago, and now makes a living from his gaming blog, which primarily chronicles the goings-on in the EVE universe. Alex is so ensconced in the governance of his alliance that he doesn't even touch the space shooting aspect of the game.
Most of what I end up doing is managing things such that it's more fun for our line members to actually play the game itself.
In the real world, Sean was working to aid the government in the midst of touchy, sometimes dangerous diplomatic quagmires. In the online world, Sean was Vilerat, one of EVE's most influential diplomats.
He was the chief diplomat of the largest alliance in the game. He also created a diplomatic corps, which was based upon the State Department itself. So now instead of having one diplomat, which is what most alliances have, we had a chief diplomat, we had several diplomatic directors, and we had attachés who were liaising with the various entities that they were focused on.
Alex and Sean both got into EVE around 2006 through a website called Something Awful, which, among many other things, plays host to a huge EVE Online alliance called Goonswarm.
I founded a espionage agency in the game, and Sean was actually one of my first agents infiltrating a hostile alliance, and we worked very, very closely together on that.
It's important to note that when you infiltrate a hostile alliance in EVE, it's not like you enter some combination of commands and bam, you've infiltrated it. You have to convince actual people to trust you. It requires persuasion, patience, and creativity. Sean excelled naturally in these situations.
So one of the most significant things that he did was managing the diplomacy of Goonswarm during an event called the Great War. The Great War was a three-year-long conflict that racked all of EVE. We're talking about a internet spaceship war here that had about 50,000 players on each side trying to kill each other for 3 years.
During the Great War, the Goonswarm were young upstarts being knocked around by a much larger alliance called the Band of Brothers, who had partnered with a smaller group called the Mercenary Coalition. It was a rough battle. Goonswarm was outclassed and outgunned. So Sean took a different tack.
Sean just started talking to their leadership. And over the course of several months of just highlighting the fact that their masters had taken credit for their actions and basically pointed out to the entire game how the Mercenary Coalition weren't really mercenaries, Sean convinced them that they should actually try to stand on their own as an independent entity and actually live up to their name.
It worked. The Mercenary Coalition declared its independence, the Band of Brothers wiped them out as retribution, and then the Goonswarm stepped in.
He managed to get this foe of ours to essentially destroy a large section of their strength, and then within about 6 months, the Great War was over, because without Mercenary Coalition backing them up, this entity was thoroughly destroyed. You're talking about entire regions and sections of space that are changing hands because of stuff that Sean had a part in.
In the real world, Sean's job at the State Department meant he was frequently in real war zones. He couldn't discuss the details of his work with his friends in Goonswarm, but they knew he wasn't always safe.
There was this period of time when Sean was deployed when the uprising in Sadr City was taking place. And so we would be sitting there chatting on the internet during the day, and he'd say something like, air raid siren. And he'd go off because they were getting shelled by these Kayatushas from Sadr City. So our conversations would periodically be interrupted by him getting rockets dropped on him. The last communication we had from him was, unfortunately, him saying, gunfire. And then, you know, that was when the compound was hit. And we never heard from him again.
His friends were used to seeing him go dark. But when Vile Rat didn't pop up for a disconcerting period of time, the goon swarm began to investigate. One of Alex's friends contacted Sean's family and found out that he'd been killed. Alex, grieving, posted a tribute to Sean on his website, not realizing that he was inadvertently breaking the news of Sean's death to the world.
Well, one of the worst things about having one of your, you know, Sean was one of my best friends. And, you know, we hung out many, many times in real life, in addition to spending every day on the internet with each other for 6+ years before he was killed. So we're trying to grieve through that and then dealing with the media. Pretty much every major entity in the Western world contacted me trying to interview me. But really what they were trying to do is, you know, get in touch with a crying widow. So I sort of ran interference for a while. And, you know, obviously the family had no desire to be contacted or discuss this with the press at all.
In a contentious presidential election season, Sean's death became just another issue to fight over. In the world of EVE Online, Biorat's death brought warring factions together.
Everyone was in shock.
Space stations in the game were renamed in Vile Rat's honor. People built memorials, signs that stretched across space that read R.I.P. Vile Rat. And they met up in-game to talk about their friend.
This is Amano Kage. It's never a good day when a good man goes down. See you among the stars, tough guy.
Goonswarm, Sean's alliance, all got together and shot each other as tribute.
You know, the old joke in EVE would be shoot blues and then tell Vile Rat. Blues being somebody who was friendly to you. Valrat was the diplomat, so if you shot a blue, you would then go have to tell Valrat and sort it out. We got together a whole bunch of people on our side, and we just sort of blew each other up as a tribute, sort of a memorial free-for-all op.
What did you personally learn from playing with him?
Oh, I learned many things. I learned a lot about reserve, about judgment, about how to interact with people. I watched him take enemies and turn them into friends, which is something that a lot of people don't realize is even possible. You think somebody doesn't like you, and then you just don't even make any effort. And Sean taught me that the effort is almost always worth it.
Do you see conflicts unfold in the game now where you think to yourself, I wish Sean were here. He would have handled this in a way that I couldn't have conceived of.
Every day. I mean, he was my right-hand man. So yes, every single day.
Today and every day for months or years to come, people are going to be posting image macros and links all over Facebook and Twitter, telling us never to forget Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans. And somewhere, floating deep in the New Eden star system, will be countless space stations and monuments to one of its most important figures. In EVE, no one will ever forget Vile Rat.
Alex Goldman is a former OTM producer. He's now the co-host of the podcast Reply All.
Coming up, the droning jargon of our government's drone policy.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Now a story, one of many when it comes to government, about how language shapes our perceptions. When The Intercept released national security documents detailing President Obama's drone strike program last week, New York Magazine pointed out two of its biggest revelations. First, there's another whistleblower who isn't Snowden. Second, In one well-documented program, for every authorized so-called target the U.S. killed, it also killed about six other people unintentionally. The Intercept also decoded the administration's vague and often misleading language on drone strikes, some of which was featured in Obama's key 2013 speech on drone policy.
We act against terrorists who pose a continuing and imminent threat to the American people. And when there are no other governments capable of effectively addressing the threat, and before any strike is taken, there must be near certainty that no civilians will be killed or injured.
Cora Currier, who covers national security and human rights for The Intercept, combed through these secret Pentagon documents.
The president's guidelines said that there must be near certainty that no civilians will be harmed or killed before a strike is taken. The documents give a different standard. They say that there must be low CDE, which means low collateral damage estimate, which is not the same thing as near certainty of no harm. Another thing that was revealed by the documents is that when the president signs off on a target, they have a 60-day window in which to hit him. That sheds some light on what it means when the president talks about somebody being a continuing imminent threat to the United States.
Okay, so near certainty that civilians won't be killed is very different from a low collateral damage estimate.
Right.
So that's number one. Number two, an imminent threat, which makes us think of a ticking time bomb, is actually a 60-day window in which a person can be killed. Let's talk about targeted killings. What does that actually mean?
The Obama administration means by that this kind of operation that falls somewhere in between the legal framework of counterterrorism and the legal framework of war.
Don't they use this term because they think that all of these operations fall under the category of war? Under U.S. law, assassinations are illegal.
Operations in Yemen and Somalia, at least, the White House says, are under the Authorization for Use of Military Force, which was passed in 2001, authorizing the U.S. to go after anyone involved in the 9/11 attacks, and therefore taking out individuals by drone strike or by other means are not assassinations. They are acts of war. They're targeted killings. And actually, it's quite interesting. As recently as 2001, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Martin Indyk, was on the record condemning what he called extrajudicial killings by the Israelis of Palestinian militants. And he said that the U.S. considered them extrajudicial killings.
What is the definition of an EKIA, an enemy killed in action?
This is a term that the military uses after an operation. In the case of drone strikes, the drone hovers over the site of a strike to see who's killed. And sources tell us that if it was a military age male, unless definitive evidence emerged to prove that they were not a militant or a suspected terrorist, the policy was just to label them EKIA.
So the EKIA doesn't mean much except that it's a male of a certain age. The administration has been at pains to describe the kind of technical and moral quandary that goes in targeting somebody for a drone strike. These are high-value targets. That's the term.
Despite the fact that they've said that there are relatively few individuals who meet the criteria, there's a few bits of evidence in these documents that throw into question the rhetoric about high-value targeting. One slide shows that there were only 16 people authorized in Yemen in June of 2012. In 2012, there were dozens of strikes, killing a minimum of over 200 people. And so the question becomes, were all of those high value? Were all of those people really an imminent threat to the United States? It certainly doesn't seem like it from the way that the Obama administration describes these people. Were they people who were killed in what are called signature strikes, which is when people are targeted because they're sort of exhibiting a pattern of behavior that looks suspicious?
A pattern of behavior that looks suspicious.
Yeah, so signature strikes were first reported on in Pakistan, and it was this idea that you would see someone who was exhibiting the signature of a terrorist, that from surveilling this person, we might not know exactly who they are, but we can see that they play a role in this organization. In Yemen, when it was reported that the Obama administration had authorized these types of strikes, the administration said, no, they're not signatures, they're TADs, terror attack disruption strikes, which conjures up this idea of something very imminent, right? A terror attack disruption. But other people describe them as basically the same thing as signature strikes.
How does it affect you to be enmeshed in this kind of jargon?
As we were reporting this, one of my editors brought it up, where we're overusing the word target when there were places that we should have said person or individual or suspected terrorist or some more specific word, because the documents throughout refer to people as targets. And we had just kind of internalized that. When you talk about that a kinetic action is an airstrike, that a finish is a kill, and that a target, you know, is a person.
Now, when outlining the drone program in 2013, Obama seemed to readily acknowledge the risks that are associated in acting with such secrecy.
The very precision of drone strikes and the necessary secrecy often involved in such actions can end up shielding our government from the public scrutiny that a troop deployment invites. It could also lead a president and his team to view drone strikes as a cure-all for terrorism.
So why hasn't the White House been more transparent about the program?
I think that's a question that you actually hear a lot from defenders of the drone program, because they say that it would serve them well to be more open and transparent about when strikes go bad, when civilians are killed, that they feel like they could more effectively push back against critics if they were more transparent. But this speech, this 2013 speech, right, this is more than 2 years old now, the White House, when you write about these issues, when you go to them with very specific questions, they just point you back to that speech constantly. And they say, you know, the president has already outlined these guidelines and, you know, that's all I've got for you.
They're just playing the tape like we are.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that more careful examination of these strikes would open the government up to a lot of questions about not only when civilians are killed, why those decisions were made.
The fact is that the ones who aren't American citizens are not noted. They're not properly counted. They're not necessarily identified in any way except by their families and friends on the ground, not by the people who have killed them.
I think that this double standard was highlighted in the CIA strike that killed the two hostages, the Italian and the American hostage in Pakistan. In that case, the White House was forced to come forward and offer a formal apology and to talk about the victims and to talk about what had gone wrong. In explaining what had gone wrong, they used the exact same language of the standards that had failed to protect them. They talked about there having been near certainty, and they talked about near continuous surveillance of the compound where they were. That admission from the White House about that mistake was so rare, and you know, it was occasioned, frankly, I think, because there were Westerners killed.
Thank you very much. Cora Currier covers national security and human rights for The Intercept.
If the police smashed through your front door, raided your desk, and started rifling through your personal communication, all without a warrant, you'd have legal recourse under the Fourth Amendment. But currently, if that same scenario played out in a virtual space, with the cops grabbing your email or phone location data, in much of the country, there'd be little you could actually do. Except now, if you live in California.
Governor Jerry Brown is busy signing bills into law, and one of the bills is a big win for privacy advocates.
A new California law requires police to get a court order before they can search messages, photographs, and other digital data stored on your phone or company servers.
The bill is supported by the ACLU, Electronic Frontier Foundation, and major tech companies like Apple, Facebook, and Google.
The email communication that I receive from my doctor, my lawyer, my partner, that may be in the cloud deserves the same protection as a Valentine that's arrived in my mailbox.
That's State Senator Mark Leno, co-sponsor of the bill, signed into law this month by California Governor Jerry Brown. Senator, welcome to On the Media.
Good to be with you, Bob.
So before Governor Jerry Brown signed this bill into law, the cops could demand my phone records from Verizon or AT&T or whoever?
They could do more than that. Upon incident of arrest, they could grab your cell phone and go through all of it, though in the same situation, they would need a warrant to get into your laptop or your desktop or to go into your desk drawer or filing cabinet. So we've been stuck in the digital dark ages. Technology has clearly moved more quickly than our state statutes. And this bill, taking effect January 1st, will rectify that situation.
Now, if the San Mateo police, that's your district, wanted my phone records, and they went to my phone carrier and said, gimme, 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 would the carriers have to comply?
That's a good question. And that's one of the reasons we had the support of the California Chamber of Commerce, all of Silicon Valley, because they've been looking for a clear and consistent standard so they would know when law enforcement contacted them and asked for your or my or any consumer's information, did they need to give it up or could they protect their consumer's privacy?
How often was it happening that the telecoms or the internet service providers were turning over the information that the police sought without a warrant?
I couldn't tell you that definitively, though we do know the number of requests have gone up exponentially in recent years. This is actually a cottage industry for the telecoms. Law enforcement actually purchase our geolocation information from them in vast amounts. Sometimes there would be a warrant, sometimes not. Most times not.
Now, three previous versions of a less comprehensive bill reached the governor's desk, and each time he vetoed them. What was different now that enabled you to get actually a far more wide-ranging piece of legislation signed into law?
We started with the geolocation piece a few years ago after a U.S. Supreme Court decision that ruled before law enforcement can put a GPS device on your automobile and follow you around that they needed to get a warrant. But of course, law enforcement doesn't need to put a GPS device on our automobiles to follow us around. We carry one in our pocket every day. So we just wanted to clarify that that U.S. Supreme Court decision meant also that before they could access our geolocation through our phones, that they would need to get a warrant. So we got the bill to Governor Brown's desk. We know that the law enforcement associations urged him to veto the bill, and he did. Then we came back with a second bill dealing with access to smartphones, and we got the bill to the governor's desk, and he vetoed it. Then our third try last year was with regard to electronic communications, emails, and text. Same playbook, same opposition, same support. Governor vetoed it as well. So this year we came back putting all three pieces, adding to it metadata, and put it all into one big bill. But we worked steadfastly and earnestly with law enforcement, and we were able, through some wordsmithing, to get them to a neutral position. I'm pleased to say that despite some funny business at the very end in the second house, with more than two-thirds support of both houses, we got the bill to the governor's desk, and this time he has signed it into law.
Wow, that is some magical wordsmithing. What did you change and what did you add in order to assuage law enforcement?
Well, for example, there was concern that this would interfere with law enforcement's sting operations in dealing with those who sexually offend against children online. So if I am communicating inappropriately, illegally with a minor, and I get caught in your sting operation, we clarified in the bill that all of that electronic communication would be yours, law enforcement, without need for a warrant. Because I gave it to you, even though I was in your sting, it doesn't matter, and there'd be no need for the warrant there. I should also point out that this bill, along with the three previous efforts, has always included a warrant exception for exigent circumstances. That means if there is a risk of flight of a perpetrator, if there is risk of destruction of evidence, if an individual is at risk of harm, the law enforcement officer can unilaterally determine that it is an emergency and the warrant requirement is waived. So that is a significant allowance.
Waived for 3 days.
Yes.
They have to come back ex post facto and present the warrant for the information that they've already got in their hands.
That's right. But they can make that determination themselves. That has always been in these bills, which is necessary for me as an author to make the case to my colleagues that we're not interfering with law enforcement's ability to deal with emergency situations.
So what's going to happen? What will change in California as a consequence of these protections now being in place.
Once the bill does take effect January 1st, if someone is subjected to a warrantless search, there will be recourse and law enforcement will have to defend themselves for what they've done because they will have broken the law. So we can go about our business with a greater certainty that our government will not be involved in our private lives in ways they should not, unless they go to a court and have that court determine that there's some probable cause that we're breaking the law before they access our private information.
Senator, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Mark Leno is a Democratic California senator representing the 11th District.
Coming up, two cinematic depictions of journalism. One true, one sort of.
This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. U.S. and Scottish investigators recently announced two new suspects in the 1988 terrorist attack on Pan Am Flight 103, better known as the Lockerbie bombing.
A major air crash tonight near the Scottish border.
A Pan-American Boeing 747 airliner flying from London to New York crashed.
Eyewitnesses report a huge explosion and a 300-foot fireball.
All 259 aboard the flight were killed, along with 11 residents of Lockerbie, Scotland, where debris from the plane left a miles-wide field of wreckage. Only one person, a Libyan man named Abdelbaset Almograhi, was convicted and imprisoned for the bombing. But he received compassionate release in 2009 because he was dying of cancer. 3 months to live turned into 3 years, and he died in 2012. Justice, it seemed, died with him. But not inquiry.
Innocent dying man or mass murderer set free.
I'm asking myself, is the murderer getting away? And how far would I go to find out whether he is who he seems to be?
Filmmaker Ken Dornstein, whose brother David died on Pan Am 103, has spent years trying to locate other figures from Muammar Gaddafi's security apparatus connected to the bombing. 27 years after the crime, his three-part series on PBS's Frontline, called My Brother's Bomber, reveals new information about a Libyan explosives expert, as well as other possible suspects. Just days after his documentary aired came the news that two of the men he reported on, Gaddafi-era spy chief Abu Senussi and Libyan explosives expert Abu Aguila Massoud, would be pursued as suspects. Dornstein does not think it's a coincidence.
I do know that in the middle of that reporting, the U.S. government did become aware of some new leads that I had developed. While I can't for sure connect the dots, I think it would be a very unlikely coincidence if the evidence that we had developed as part of this series hadn't in some pretty substantial way been baked into the news that we heard this week officially.
Tell me about your reporting, what you had in mind when you got started.
You know, there was a docudrama made very early on in the first year or so after the bombing, and it was done by a British television outfit. And I remember seeing it when I was 20 or 21, and There was a very vivid scene of someone parting some beaded curtains, and there was a bomb maker in there at his workshop, and he's connecting wires. It planted in my mind a kind of a fantasy that there were places where these people worked and lived, and that you could, if you were clever enough, find them and confront them. Though I didn't really begin the reporting that became this film until 2011, I did have a naive idea about doing something like this, dating all the way back. I had this list of names. They'd been pulled from the files of the original investigation, and I thought one of them would open the door.
And in fact, let's listen to some tape of the retired Scottish investigator.
Every one of these, at some stage, played a part. And a surprise expert in charge, explosives in particular. A surprise mechanic, you could say, that started the ball rolling. He holds a key to it all. These are the people that must be found, and these are the people who are responsible. But they never, ever got access to them long enough to interview any of them.
So you go down this list, and one of them dies of prostate cancer, the only man convicted in the crime. Another is a key henchman of Muammar Gaddafi, who in the final days of his regime, Gaddafi assassinates. Others are murdered by militants in the chaos that came with the fall of the Gaddafi regime. Eventually, there's three people you isolate who are the keys to this story. And one is a black Libyan whom the Scottish investigator a moment ago referred to as the surprise man. Who is it?
I call him Abu Aguila, or it's Abu Aguila Massoud, or sometimes he's just called Massoud. When you pour through tens of thousands of pages of trial transcript and declassified documents, you don't see his name a lot, but you see it a few times. He's right next to the one guy who was convicted, Abdel Basset al-Megrahi, and he's right there at the moment, if the prosecution theory is right, when that bomb was inserted into the luggage system and forwarded on to Flight 103. So he's in the right place at the right time. They had his landing cards, and they had dusted them for fingerprints, and there was this passport number. That's who he was for me for years. He was a name and a passport number and a fingerprint. And so there's years of searching for someone I'm not even sure exists until I come across someone who actually admits they know him.
Aha. And this guy admitted his participation in a German discotheque bombing, also at the orders of the Gaddafi regime.
That's right. He said that there was a bomb expert who came in to help us, and that man's name was Abu Aguila Massoud. There was that name. And then when I went further into the evidence, there was that passport number, the same one that I'd seen on that landing card, and it confirmed for me that this mystery person traveling with al-Megrahi, the one man convicted, was himself a bomb expert, maybe a bomb maker. That was a kind of game-changing realization.
At this stage, I just want to remind our listeners that you have a very personal stake in all of this as the brother of one of the victims of the Lockerbie bombing. And this gets me to that third character who plays such a prominent role in your film. He's Swiss. He runs a small electronics firm that makes timing devices such as used in the Lockerbie bombing and was personally acquainted with all of the conspirators and was a long-term vendor to the Gaddafi regime. You spend a lot of time with him. Most cordially, what was that experience like?
Edwin Bollier saw our encounter as a kind of a chess match. As a documentary filmmaker, if someone is willing to film, it means that there's something they want from the encounter. Sometimes I think the true subject of what we're talking about is not, are they telling you the truth? Are they lying to you? It's more, are they lying to themselves? Edwin Bollier doesn't talk about the Lockerbie bombing, the actual event that killed 270 people. Edwin Bollier talks about the Lockerbie affair, which in his mind is an elaborate plot to frame Megrahi, the Libyans, and himself for the bombing.
So you're saying it wasn't Libya?
Yes.
And it wasn't Abdel Basset al-Megrahi? Yes. And it wasn't your timer?
Yes.
And we don't know who fabricated
Yes.
the evidence
Yes.
against Libya
Yes.
and you?
Yes.
We know nothing.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, true. When you see from this side, we know nothing.
Where am I emotionally? I think I'm trying to confront him with bits of new evidence. And while the camera's running, I want to see how he reacts to it because even if someone doesn't intend to tell you the truth, if I wait long enough, maybe the truth will emerge anyway.
Now, had you done this on assignment from Frontline, there's a number of things in this film that in no way would they have permitted. There are a number of people you spoke to from whom you withheld the central purpose of your questions. There was a scene where you went into the home of the dying Al-Megrahi with a hidden camera that you were prepared to use to get him on tape without his knowledge in his deathbed. These are not kosher journalistic techniques. Tell me what the conversations were like with the executives at Frontline.
By the time, you know, it came to actual discussions with Frontline about what should or shouldn't be in the film, I think we had a sense of what I had done journalistically. The decisions themselves weren't made lightly. It's not good for someone who wants to be in the business of being a filmmaker, approaching people and saying, you need to trust me, and outing yourself as somebody who in certain situations films or records secretly. That's not a smart thing to do. It's not an ethical thing to do. There was the requisite hand-wringing on my part. And yet, I was confronted in certain situations with the idea that I was going to be in a room with someone, maybe for the only time ever, and they could potentially tell me something. I very much wanted people to see what I saw so that it couldn't be denied.
And now finally, 27 years after the murders, are you finished?
I want to say reflexively, yes. Right now, it's in the hands of people who could advance it beyond what a filmmaker could do. I'm not finished with it in the sense that it marks you in a certain way, and it's bound up with who my brother was himself, and I'm sorry he's gone. And in some ways, having a project around him is a way of continuing a relationship with him. I won't let it go in the sense that I will stop thinking about the bombing, but yes, I'm done with it in the sense that the continuing invitations I have to go to a Libyan jail and come face to face with this man who I think is the bomb maker, I don't see myself taking any time soon.
Ken, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob, for having me.
Ken Dornstein made the 3-part documentary about the Lockerbie bombing called My Brother's Bomber for Frontline.
Hi, Dad.
Hi, guys.
Say hi to Dad.
Can you guys imagine still caring about a story even 25 years later? Like,
yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. If it made my brother die.
Yeah.
Last week, the film Truth opened in the U.S., starring Robert Redford as former CBS anchor Dan Rather and Cate Blanchett as his lead producer for 60 Minutes, Mary Mapes. The film chronicles a journalistic fiasco that unfolded in the months leading up to the 2004 presidential election, when 60 Minutes ran a story on gaps in President Bush's military record.
What's our next move?
I might have something for the election.
The president of the United States may have gone AWOL from the military.
He never even showed up.
Those parts of his file they didn't like, they tossed in a wastebasket.
Do you have these documents?
The problem was that the explosive documents, the splashiest part of the story, were of dubious and unverifiable origin, which, along with several other journalistic missteps, resulted in CBS launching an independent investigation of the report, disowning the 60 Minutes story, firing Mary Mapes, and prematurely retiring Dan Rather after 24 years on the job. The film, based on a book by Mary Mapes, seeks to exculpate the 60 Minutes crew and vindicate their reporting, in large part by suggesting that corporate and political forces deliberately buried them and their legitimate story. Joe Hagan is a contributing editor for New York Magazine who watched the story unfold in 2004. Unsatisfied with its conclusions, he went in search of the truth himself, getting to know Mapes and the rest of the former CBS crew in the process. His 10,000-word-plus investigation ran in Texas Monthly in 2012. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, what did you think of the movie?
Oh, my God, I had complicated feelings about it. You know, I mean, it's Hollywood. It's very kind of rousing and presents Dan Rather and Mary Mapes' producer as martyrs. The film is trying to win the argument of history on emotional grounds, with stirring music and a certain point of view, when it is very much the view of David and Goliath versus the zero-sum game of journalism and politics that is the reality.
Talk about the zero-sum game.
The zero-sum game is the intensity of attention on every single bit of information. I mean, the sources for every political story in an election cycle are coming from some place. And the fact is, you are vetting this stuff. You are moderating this warfare. If you've got something that looks like it's a radioactive piece of information 2 months before the election, it has to be right.
Core to this film is a character named Burkett, who was hostile to Bush, a former guardsman himself, who is the source of these documents and played by Stacy Keach in the movie, right?
Yeah, he does a really great job. Although he doesn't make him quite as sort of unhinged as he seemed to me. Yeah, I met him in a Mexican restaurant somewhere east of Dallas, and I heard his whole story. And he would tell these epic tales that seemed very dubious.
Like?
That he had been involved in war games in which he led some sort of battalion and that he defeated Tommy Franks in the war games that they had in Texas. A guy who clearly wanted to feel like he was a part of some grand narrative. And I remember meeting him thinking, God, I would be very scared to get anything from this guy. You know, he obviously lied to them. He told them he got these from another friend of his named George Kahn. And then he told a story that was the most unbelievable Carl Hyacinth-style story that he got them from some anonymous person who had called him from a Holiday Inn, said, come meet me at a cattle show, a stranger in a cowboy hat. I mean, it was all kind of like, whoa, really? Mm-hmm. This is where we're going with this? That was a big moment for me because I kind of had to look at Mary Mapes and her research assistant, and I liked them, but I also wondered how they could have trusted this guy.
Topher Grace plays one of the members of Mary Mapes' research team, is fired, and he delivers a speech about how Viacom is doing this in exchange for some very explicit regulatory favors from the Bush White House.
Your parent company is currently lobbying a Republican-controlled Congress for deregulation and tax breaks that could potentially save them hundreds of millions of dollars. And we just aired a report that could cost those same Republicans the presidency. You think Viacom might need the administration on their side? You think they might be desperate to make it up to them right now?
Topher Grace was playing Mike Smith, who was the assistant. And when I really got deep into this story, it was to go see him because he had tape recorded all of his phone conversations with CBS executives. So I spent days and days listening to these tapes with this guy. And in fact, Sumner Redstone, who was the CEO of Viacom, was quoted, I believe it was in Time or Newsweek, saying that he wanted Bush to win because it was in his interest. And one of the cassette tapes that I was listening to was a phone call with one of the executives at CBS saying, why did he say that? Oh, why did he have to go and say that? What an idiot. And it is also true that the lobbyist for Viacom was the one who was actively involved in selecting a Republican to head the Thornburg Commission that would review the CBS report.
You didn't prove the memos are real. The burden of proof is on you.
By that standard, the Times would never have run the Pentagon Papers. The Post would never have listened to Deep Throat.
I always thought the Thornburg Commission was always a sort of dog and pony show to kind of placate the powers that be, and that the reaction by CBS to retire Dan Rather, fire Mary Mapes, get rid of all these other producers, I don't feel like the punishment fit the crime. I feel like it was part of the political atmosphere of the time. I remember sitting in this hotel with Mary Mapes and Mike Smith. She was in the bar drinking, totally traumatized by everything that had happened. Mike Smith had taken a Valium and passed out on my hotel bed while I was filing my story. I only bring this up because, in a way, that's what the movie was really about, the trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder of these reporters who got whacked. Now, they are trying to merge that with this high, vaunted idea of journalism, and they don't go together. I mean, that's the sad thing. And I have a lot of emotional sympathy for them because I watched them suffer in the face of all of this stuff. But at the end of the day, it happened to them because mistakes were made. That's what's at stake. You see what's at stake. You know, it's power and it's money and it's people's lives. But if you're not right, you're going to be roadkill on the highway.
But leaving whether or not these guys suffered too much aside, it's the story that suffered too. This story that had a lot of evidence and raised legitimate questions,
yes,
would never be heard from again. What did Walter Robinson of the Globe, who also reported it, call it?
It's the cork in the story, right? That you could never go back to the story again because they botched it. Everybody had a point of view about Dan Rather and Mary Mapes and CBS. They became the story. When you step back from the whole thing and you look at what Walter Robinson reported, what the LA Times reported, what lots of different people did, and I tried to do this in Texas Monthly a few years ago, just what do we know? I mean, it's so obvious that George Bush got in to get out of Vietnam, that there was preferential treatment by his commanders who were completely corrupt. And
that he was allowed to skip out on his service on a campaign.
You would have to be just very naive to look at the facts of the case and not see what it was, which, again, maybe makes it doubly depressing.
This being Hollywood,
yes,
you see a lot of Hollywood journalism tropes. One scene that almost had me laughing out loud was when the big story about Bush first aired, and you see America at the barber shop, in the bar, mm-hmm. at yeah. home, in the living room, and the world has stood still because of this 60 Minutes piece about Bush's record in the National Guard.
Right.
Like any individual news organization could have that kind of impact anymore.
Well, that's what the movie is trying to romanticize and say what we were doing when we were doing the evening news broadcast in a three-network universe was this indispensable check on power that somehow won't exist in a world with bloggers, when in fact, now there's just a much more complex ecosystem. And in many ways, there's more truth getting out now than ever before. And by the way, what they didn't show as they pan from crowd to crowd watching 60 Minutes and stopping everything they're doing was these bloggers calling BS on the whole thing and saying, hey, that doesn't look right to me. And then they start blogging on the internet. Well, that was the moment in which the media changed. And you've got a whole brave new world suddenly.
Joe, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Joe Hagan is a contributing editor to New York Magazine.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Alex Friedland, Joel Werner, and Dasha Litsitsina. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Means.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.